what you really care about is what their motivation is. And in fact, most people will say their motivation is financial, but you know, the research doesn't really back that up at all. In fact, usually it's a lot of other factors that influence how people feel at work, how they perform, and that way of thinking about it, that they're actually choosing to be there and at your company, on your team, and not at a competitor, is I think a useful way of thinking about autonomy.
Are you new to working from home? Maybe you're figuring out how to manage a distributed team. Are you homeschooling your kids while trying to get something, anything else done? You've come to the right place. Work Life at Home talks with both newbies and experts as we explore the tools, tips, and techniques that will help you make the most of this new way of working. I'm Josh Freeman. Welcome home. Remote working is pretty clearly the way forward for many of us. Even once we're fully reopened, and as we record this, many countries are still struggling with COVID, people and companies have discovered the benefits of working from home. It's not right for everyone, obviously, but it's right for a lot of us. And managing remote teams effectively will be a critical skill for leaders everywhere. Lucas Shermer is the author of Align Remotely: How to Achieve Together When Everyone is Working from Home. He's also host of the podcast Managing Remote Teams. In addition to his own years of experience managing remote work, he's interviewed experts from across the globe. Luke's goal is to help teams thrive and achieve more together when working remotely. Let's find out how he does that and how we can all be better leaders of our far-flung crews. Luke, welcome to Work Life at Home.
Thank you very much.
So tell me about your own experience leading teams. How did you start? Where were you working? What were you doing?
Absolutely. So it was kind of a gradual process because I was working for a software company based out of London, and the teams were distributed, but kind of in different offices. So there were already different locations involved. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was the 2012 Olympics when the company instituted all the security policies and everything to be able to have the whole company work in the London office, work from home. And I mean, occasionally we'd work from home and that kind of thing. But I think that was the first aha moment that, in fact, everyone can work from home and actually still things happen. Things get done.
Shockingly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So over time, what happened was that I realized that effectively being in London is optional if that's the case. I mean, it did take a few good years. I kind of moved from being first kind of a line contributor as a developer to kind of managing small teams and managing larger teams and managing teams of teams. And somewhere along the line, I realized that, in fact, you know, I can pretty much be anywhere because my people are all over the place anyway. I didn't have anyone in the London. Actually, no, I had one developer in the London office, but beyond that, you know, groups of people scattered over lots of different locations, both in offices and working from home. And in fact, where I was completely irrelevant.
So where were you actually? You were in the office, right, in London at that point? Or were you working from home yourself?
Well, it was kind of a mix. I mean, because we had the option of working from home at any time. And then I realized that I wanted to go and move to Poland. My wife got a job offer out here. And originally I'm from here, and I had a daughter. So it kind of made sense to be back in more of a family context. Mm-hmm. And especially as my daughter was very young then. Now she's still young, but a little older. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just making the leap, I think, was a lot easier than I expected, actually. I mean, I think the main difference professionally was that most of my stakeholders were based in London because I had a good relationship with them. It worked well enough. Whereas in terms of actually working with the team, it was completely irrelevant. And in fact, I could kit out my home office however I wanted and felt a lot more productive, actually, I think, when I did do that after having moved.
So your stakeholders, your bosses, whatever they were in that context, how did they respond when you finally made the move and you disappeared to Poland, essentially, and they didn't see you every day? What was their take on that? Or did they have any reaction?
They obviously were open to it. I think initially the plan was that I'd be coming back once a month, flying in to kind of speak with them. And I think I did that for the first 2 or 3 months. Then it became once every 2 months, then once every 3 months. And then kind of it just became as needed. And all of the communication that we had was still very much the same. It's just they didn't physically see me sitting at my computer in the London office. But beyond that, all the work was being done and the software was being built and everybody was happy pretty much.
I'm guessing if it's like a lot of companies, including our own, even when you're in a physical space sharing office space with people, you're focused on your own work and your communications often happen by email or whatever the communication is that's text-based in your working environment, even if you're literally 10 feet away from people because people work asynchronously and they're in meetings or they have different timeframes or whatever and you need to communicate something. So the weirdness is that a lot of the time you're working essentially remotely, even if you're actually in the same place. And I'm guessing that helped the transition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, certainly the work pattern in that company, and I think in a lot of certainly IT companies, I think it's naturally asynchronous. I mean, there are benefits from being together in one place. And sometimes that's what you want. But I mm-hmm. think in this particular case, because the work was largely asynchronous and when needed, you could have a synchronous meeting or, you know, you'd have Slack, you'd have email, you'd have that kind of thing. It was pretty much irrelevant.
All right. So let's dive into the book and the areas of focus of the book. You talk about productivity, alignment, and meetings as kind of the main areas of focus in managing remote teams. And tell us how you define those and how you think about those and why you split them up like that.
Yeah, sure. So I think those are the three areas where I had the biggest learnings around moving to remote as I did that. So in terms of productivity, everybody has their own definition to some extent. And in fact, this becomes quite important when moving to remote, because if you're measuring productivity based on things like time being spent, then that is very difficult to do. And it's quite frustrating when you do have a distributed team and you don't actually see people. Whereas it's much better to be productive by having clear goals and outcomes and then going and pursuing them. So that's on the productivity side. In terms of alignment, a lot of that is around how quickly decisions are made amongst groups of stakeholders and to a lesser extent, the team also. Because I think that if there is a strong pressure for speed and getting things done quickly, I think at some point, if the team itself is moving quite quickly, then in fact, it's the time waiting for the decision to be made that actually becomes a significant bottleneck.
For sure.
And in terms of meetings, I mean, I think this is kind of what everyone's felt with Zoom fatigue since the beginning of last year. I think, you know, they're on one hand, meetings are necessary and useful and if done well, fun. On the other hand, being in meeting after meeting back to back all day is completely draining, if not soul sucking.
Right. So, yeah. I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of assumptions that I think I had initially, and I think which a lot of people had in the early days of the pandemic around meetings, which when you really dig down deeper under the hood, then I think there's actually quite a lot there in terms of figuring out how to get meetings to be fun and effective, basically.
I don't know. You know, I'm wondering if it's harder online or easier online in some ways, that the idea of like 20 people sitting around in a meeting with half of them on their phones, checking texts and the way that they work and everybody goes around the room and introduces themselves or says their little piece or whatever it is. And people are bored out of their minds. And in a way, online meetings, they certainly don't have to be like that. I think they probably are like that a lot of the time, but keeping them focused and short and fresh, I think people, like from the Zoom fatigue you were talking about, people are exhausted, sick of them, don't really want to be on long meetings. And maybe everybody's on the same page about that at this point. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the big factor that kind of spans both is facilitation. And I think most managers, when they go in to manage teams, they don't see facilitation as a core skill. Whereas I think it's useful in an in-person context to be more, let's say, facilitative and planning out meetings as kind of workshops where needed, or actually designing the meeting around what it is that needs to be done in an online context where you need to be deliberate about everything pretty much. It becomes absolutely critical. So if you do have a facilitation skills gap, everybody feels it right away. So ideally, when you do plan online meetings or workshops, you're really creating the meeting in a way as an experience to help the team come together and decide something quickly and effectively, as quickly and effectively as possible. Mm-hmm. And taking advantage of what online has to offer. Like, I mean, personally, I'm a huge fan of whiteboards. They were extremely helpful, both when I was at that company and also since then. And all the tools like timers and being able to think visually and being able to have everyone at the same time contribute, let's say, post-its and discuss and kind of work at multiple levels at the same time and really explore new spaces when you're trying to figure out what the best way of doing something is.
So what do you use to do that online? Do you use Miro or something like that? Or what tools do you use for whiteboarding?
Yeah. So at that company, we started using Miro as soon as it got to a point where it was relatively stable. I mean, I'd been looking at this space for a while. I think initially we were using things like idea boards, which was a free way of getting some basic post-it type stuff working for things like a retrospective. But as soon as Miro got, let's say, quick enough to use, we certainly went in that direction. Since then, I think also Mural I've used quite a bit. So I think that gives you a lot of ability to help everyone collaborate. For example, compared to an in-person workshop, what these tools give you is that because they're digital, you've got all the benefits of that. Once you have like one whiteboard up where you've explored a whole bunch of things, you can easily duplicate and then make variations of them, for example. If you want to look at that, you don't need to kind of pull all of your things down like at the end of the workshop because the meeting room is going to be used by somebody else. Right. Just leave it up.
Yeah.
And then in between iterations of the workshop, you can have people, you know, have thoughts in the shower or something that they go and they put up on the whiteboard. So there's a lot of these extra little benefits that you get from having that. And because it's virtual, it's accessible anywhere. Therefore, it naturally slots into the kind of the whole remote way of working.
So recently I was in a meeting where it felt like they were sort of over facilitating. You know, I don't know about whether that occurs in your world, but this was a fairly informal sort of short, wasn't really a heavy duty problem solving meeting. It was more almost an introductory, let's talk about a couple of things kind of meeting. And it was one of these things with an extremely formal agenda that felt weirdly inappropriate, I guess, for the kind of more casual conversation that it was. And I'm wondering, how do you balance the formality of needing to structure the meetings carefully and make them work well with the need for people to connect online in a kind of a more social and casual way because we're distanced from each other and don't have that much time to sort of interact socially? How do you find that balance?
Yeah, so I think two things come to mind. So first of all, not everything needs to be a workshop. even though that's kind of the natural direction that I typically go in more of a development context, I mean, there's different kinds of meetings and not everything needs to be done in a highly, let's say, facilitated way, for example.
Right. Yeah.
I think a really useful way of thinking about meetings in general comes from game storming. I had Dave Mastronardi from GameStorming on my podcast, and you know, we talked about this whole way of, at least within a meeting, where you first start off the meeting, where you allow things to diverge, then you kind of dig into the details, and then you converge on whatever it is that you need to decide or do. And even as an informal rule of thumb, I think it's useful. So even if it is somewhat of a loose chat, or you know, even something like a podcast episode, like I find that useful as a way of thinking about a discussion.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I mean, just making sure that you've figured out who needs to be there and roughly what all of you want to talk about. I think that's kind of like the ideal, I think, level of structure to start with. And then, of course, you can do more or less beyond that. But I think most meetings would benefit from at least that level of structure.
That makes a lot of sense. It's kind of an art, I think, that you develop as a manager, as a leader of meetings, where you sense what's going on with it. And then you can kind of bring it back to its focus when it's getting a little too chaotic and loose or boring. Take your pick.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's come back to autonomy for a second.
Sure.
This idea that people had, certainly at the start of the pandemic, and I think people maybe still have this discomfort of not being able to sort of keep an eye on your employees and have them like know if they're working or not. And mm-hmm. in the world of your world, software development, and my world of design and writing and things like that, those activities, you need blocks of time. People disappear for a while and they go do the thing and then they come back with the result of their work. And that's almost an inherent and normal part of the way that we work, whether we're in an office or we're not in an office. You know, it's like it's built into the type of work that we do. And I don't know whether that is true for most work that's not hands-on stuff, you know, most thought-based work. But nonetheless, the old-time managers are really uncomfortable with that. And they want to see the hours that you put in and they want to see, like, you know, see that you're at your desk and all of that good stuff. So that clearly doesn't work with remote working. And how do you make someone comfortable who's used to thinking in those terms? And how do they make that transition? How should they be thinking about it?
Well, to some extent, this is one of the things that was forced on people, forced on especially senior managers with various levels of effect. I mean, essentially, we're talking about a mindset shift that as a, let's say, senior manager, you need to accept that most people actually want to do a job and they care about doing a good job.
Right, which theoretically is why you hired them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then I think if you start getting too much into the detail of how many hours they worked on this and that, then it starts creating this kind of presumption that that's not the case. And in fact, I think a really good mindset shift for me was early on, I think pre-pandemic, was when I was having more and more people that I was working with and collaborating with, that essentially everyone that I'm working with, it's best to think of them as if they were volunteers. I had some previous experience kind of just in various NGOs. And I mean, it's the same kind of setup in that what you really care about is what their motivation is. And in fact, most people will say their motivation is financial, but you know, the research doesn't really back that up at all.
Right.
Beyond a certain level of earnings of around 75K. In fact, usually it's a lot of other factors that influence how people feel at work, how they perform, and that way of thinking about it, that they're actually choosing to be there and at your company, on your team, and not at a competitor, is I think a useful way of thinking about autonomy.
I love this idea. That's great.
And yeah, so I think a lot of details come out of that mindset. So for example, you collaborate with the team when you're setting direction, not telling them what to do. Mm-hmm. Ask them how they feel about a certain proposal. Be willing to second guess yourself publicly, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, part of your role is also to clarify structure, standards, any kind of guideposts in terms of timeframes, that kind of thing. I think people still need that, especially when you have a large group of people that you're trying to coordinate.
Right.
But it's ideally done in a way where you're giving them something that they find useful and they understand why it's there, and not something that's being done kind of to them.
So if you have a group of volunteers in the world of nonprofits, which I have some experience in as well, you sometimes have people who are well-meaning but flaky and don't get their piece of it done in time, which throws the entire project off track. How do you bring those people back on? And it is different, I'm sure. That's probably the big difference between volunteerism and actually being paid, because your one recourse is you can fire them. But let's assume it's not as bad as that. How do you manage the process so it doesn't get out of control and give people the kind of feedback that lets them know that they're holding up the whole train here with the way that they're working?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the key word there is feedback.
Right.
I think the way that I've learned how to do this is using something that Jonathan Raymond came up with. So essentially, he's got a framework where when you see something that you don't expect, you say that you noticed that this happened, and then mm-hmm. you wait, give that particular person space to talk about that, figure out what happened, why it happened, what they might do differently. Mm-hmm. The next time you raise it would be if you continue seeing a pattern of something not happening the way that you would expect. Mm-hmm. So again, it's kind of another, let's say, signpost for a conversation. And, you know, if beyond that, the person doesn't come up and take accountability for the particular thing that's happening, then at that point, you have another conversation where you structure it as, okay, we need to fix this and come up with a plan, with a time frame of when this is going to change, and basically agree that. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, if that's still not changing the situation, then at that point, it's basically time to talk about having the person possibly, you know, move on to something else. Mm-hmm. So either letting them go or somehow significantly changing the situation.
Yeah. Put them in a different role. Turns out they're not good at what you thought they might be good at. Maybe they're good at something else.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the reason why I found that really helpful is that I think I had the most difficulty with those first conversations. Mm-hmm. So when I would notice something, but I didn't want to kind of offend them. Yeah. And I think the language of framing it as I noticed that this is going on, I found super helpful.
Yeah. It sounds great.
Because it is more of a coaching type of approach. I think. I think the idea here isn't really to confront them. It's still assuming that they're trying to do their best work. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you're looking at it from the perspective of what the company needs. And if you're noticing something that isn't according to what you think the group needs or the team needs, then you really do need to raise that and, let's say, confront it, but not necessarily turn it into a full-on conflict.
I agree. And it sounds like being a good parent, you know, it's kind of the same thing you do with your kids. It's like, you don't start screaming at them the second they do something that you're not expecting. You talk to them about it and you figure it out. And not that we should be paternalistic with our employees, but the skills are somewhat similar, that you're trying to get through to somebody and help them do a better job and approach them with some care and with some thought for who they are. And, you know, you still have to be responsible, you know, to your client or your company, but doing it in a way that generates results instead of makes you feel better because you got pissed off and angry and blew off steam, which is not helpful.
Yeah, not helpful.
You use a phrase in the book where you talk about judiciously using rest. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
This is in the context of the discussion of managing energy and not time, especially in a remote context. I mean, the same is true in the office, but I think it's just harder because you're in person. But particularly with creative work like software or design or writing or similar things, I think mm-hmm. what you really care about is when you have high levels of energy, you're in a high state of flow, and you get a lot done and you become highly productive. And this is a kind of yet another reason why managing kind of hours isn't a good idea. And, you know, even within one day, if you introspect enough, I think I certainly can say so for myself. I mean, there's parts of the day where I'm feeling much more, let's say, energetic and productive compared to others. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if I am at a point where I need to get through something, but I don't have enough energy or I have low energy and therefore the quality of what I do is going to be lower, it might very well make sense to actually go and, you know, take a nap or, mm-hmm. or meditate or uh-huh. just do something else, basically.
Yeah.
Something completely not work related. And then come back to it, you know, if you're really pressed for time in 15 minutes, if you have a bit more, then, you know, or you're really drained, then just come back to it the next day. This insight originally comes from a book called The Power of Full Engagement. And I think it was basically looking at the top tennis players, the ones who were actually winning tournaments. I mean, they were all, let's say, comparable in terms of talent levels and work ethic. The guys who were winning were the ones who were actually very judiciously figuring out when they needed to be resting and how much in order to be able to time that moment when they're at absolutely peak energy so that they can really full on perform.
And on a micro level, this is kind of what the Pomodoro technique is about, right? That the idea of you work for bursts and then you take a little rest and then you work for a burst and it gives you a moment to recover. It's like working out. Same idea. You've got to have time for your brain and your body to recover and get back to it. Yeah. And give yourself, build up the energy again. I think it's a problem for people who actually work at home because there is a tendency to just keep going. And I know that there was a study, and I don't remember whose it is, but I remember discussing it with one of my guests about this idea that people actually work longer hours than they do at the office. And there's a tendency to just think, well, you know, especially if you care about what you do, to just, well, I'll just go for another hour. I'll just do another thing, you know. Oh yeah, I can do that after dinner. And you end up, you know, putting in 12-hour days on a regular basis, and it's not particularly healthy or productive. You eventually, the quality of your work just falls apart, and it's not good for you. It's not good for the team either.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, it's Josh. We'll be back in a minute. But first, I want to tell you about my company, Free Associates, which sponsors this podcast. Free Associates is a brand strategy and design agency that's created highly successful, large-scale programs for some very big companies, Tempur-Pedic and Sealy, Kenwood Audio, Belkin Components, Memorex, to name just a few. And we've also worked for plenty of much smaller companies. We've helped brand events like the Bi-Coastal Revlon Run Walk and the Mercedes-Benz Cup Tennis Championship. We've helped for-profit enterprises and nonprofits alike, new brands just starting out, and long-established brands who want to bring their image and identity into the 21st century. And we've done all this as a distributed company with nearly everyone on our team working from home since I founded the firm in 1993. If you've got a brand that needs defining or refreshing, and you want some help from a small firm with big experience, visit freeassociates.net or email me here, josh@worklifeathome.com. Free Associates, fresh, seasoned, ready to help you transform your business. Let's talk about staying in communication and creating an operational heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that's about.
So this comes from my thinking around productivity. I mean, I think it was difficult to really talk about productivity as long as we were focused on how each individual person was being productive. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I think I started looking at actual overall team output that I got closer to what actually mattered, and it made it easier to then figure out how to optimize that flow and get the whole system of work to be efficient. And part of that was figuring out at what rate could the team actually finish pieces of work that they were tasked with. And what this operational heartbeat is essentially looking at an output metric per task or per user story in this case, in terms of the...
You're using an agile system, I assume, to manage this. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So using an agile system or per story point, I think I got even that crazy and went to that level.
Okay.
So essentially not looking at the final output when all of it's done and only using that as a proxy for how much is done. It's more looking at how long it takes to finish each particular thing on average. Mm-hmm. And then using that as a, let's say a heartbeat, a kind of a measure of how well the team is doing now. Mm-hmm. The key metric where this came from was looking at the cycle time of the work being done. So basically from the moment where we accepted that something needed to be done to the moment that it was fully completed by the entire team. So that would include specifying it, developing it, reviewing it, testing it, and getting the whole thing done. Kind of looking at that full length of time on a per task level gave us almost a near real time sense of how things were actually going. So initially, when we first started looking at this, it was taking two to four weeks per task. We'd have a lot of them on. It would just take a long time to complete things. And I think by focusing on this kind of operational heartbeat and looking at how we can speed up that process, it made it a lot easier for the team to actually speed it up. And we got it down from those, you know, 3 weeks down to, I think, at the peak point, it was like 37 hours of from start to finish with all of the handoffs.
Okay. And what, so there's a lot of questions that occur to me as a result of this, but one of them is the idea of comparing what seemed like they would be highly variable tasks to try to find a way to figure out what an average would be given the nature of developing a feature, and some features are easy to implement and some are hard and take longer. And how do you find a way to compare those things?
So this is why I went in that direction of going down to story points. So using, again, this agile process where before a team commits to doing a task, there's a whole process where they estimate how big the task is using a certain number of points to proxy for, you know, is it kind of a small task? Is it a large task? Is it a super large task? That kind of thing. And then using those numbers, those story points, once a task was completed, then they would get, let's say, that total number of story points that they completed, so to speak, would then be factored into the kind of average rate effectively. So that way you proxied for this variability in the size of the individual tasks.
And they get better at estimating those, right?
And over time they get better at estimating it, exactly. Yeah. So both the estimates got better, plus on top of that, the actual process became more streamlined and worked better.
And how did that happen? How did you streamline the process?
Essentially, it was figuring out one by one where all of the bottlenecks were and going and addressing them. And a lot of them actually weren't necessarily in the work being done, but in the context in which the team was operating in. So a lot of that ended up being, you know, on my plate to go and get access to certain resources, to get access to, I don't know, servers, to be able to go and kind of dynamically create testing environments, like all of these various ideas that we had for streamlining things. First, we identified them and then we kind of knocked them off one by one. And of course, also the team within themselves got a cleaner sense of exactly what needs to happen at each stage and enforced it as they worked. And therefore, it just became easier and easier to just talk about, okay, how do we get the pace of work to be better? Of course, not compromising on quality at all. So I think that's the other part. So we had we defined exactly what it means to be done. So again, using agile terminology, and broke that down into what it means for each stage of the process. And then people would, for example, if something wasn't ready for code review, then there would be a clear set of criteria for what it means to be ready for code review. Therefore, if it's not ready, it goes back to code review. It goes back to the developer to finish off whatever it is that needed to be done. And as that became more and more of a habit for each of the team members, and they also collaborated with each other, that time started trending downwards until it got quite fast overall.
It's interesting because it sounds like the process of writing code itself, that you come up with this idea of a way of doing something and it's initially fairly well thought out, but as you work on it, you refine it and you find, oh, there's a faster, easier way of doing this, more efficient. And you kind of reconnect two pieces and drop out all the crap in the middle. And then, you know, and it makes the code efficient and it gradually becomes more and more efficient as you work on it. It seems like that's a similar, I don't know, it's sort of a metaphor for what you're doing.
Yeah, it's very much a systems-based approach to to managing and kind of optimizing a process in the same way that you'd be able to think about work coming through. I mean, there's a guy, Don Reinertsen, who I think modeled product development output the same way that you would with an operating system. So you have requests for work coming in of random size, at random frequency, of random length, basically, which is pretty much the same thing that you expect of a product development team. I mean, depending on how numerical you want to get about it, but the same ways of thinking about getting an operating system to work well is the same way that you think about getting a product development team to work well.
So in a well-defined agile story, you understand the purpose of what you're doing very clearly before you start. And it sounds like that's sort of you know, leading into this metaphorical conversation we're having here, that's mm-hmm. how you get alignment within the team. So you want to expand on how you set up alignment and how you know if it's working.
Yes, there's basically things going on at a couple of different levels.
Okay, so, good. Yeah.
So I think there's a certain level of context that you need to have at a, let's say, very senior level where you have an idea, okay, let's go and build, let's say, this type of product. Right. Then there's a more operational level, which is roughly where we're, which is the level we're talking about here. So like, what are the tasks? What's the breakdown and that kind of thing? And then you've got mm-hmm. the level below that of for any given task, you want clarity on what it is that needs to be built and how it needs to work and what all the, you know, edge cases are and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much you need necessarily alignment to get at that lowest level. Mm-hmm. But before you get to that lowest level, if you don't have that top level picture figured out and agreed, then the stuff at the bottom is irrelevant, basically.
Right, right, right.
So yeah, I think a lot of the challenge around these projects were largely that there's this high level description where there would be a lot kind of implicitly embedded in what it is that needs to be built. And then figuring out what the simplest way to achieve that is mm-hmm. took a good amount of time because it wasn't only about customer requirements. There was mm-hmm. a lot of requirements around the technologies being used, the things that were being integrated with, unlike, let's say, the usual, let's say, lean startup approach of just validating, you know, customer needs and going in, you know, more design world. So I guess what you're comfortable with. I mean, that's also still true, but there was a good amount of validation that needed to happen, let's say technically. So a large part of the work initially was having the team validate and define what the scope was.
Okay.
So it was super meta.
But it sounds like you need to try to generalize this. It sounds like when you are working with a remote team, getting them to all see the goal or see the problem the same way is kind of what you're trying to do. It's getting everybody to face the same direction at the mm-hmm. same time. And so they kind of, you know, they all feel like they're part of some larger chain of events or something that's all moving toward a large goal that needs to be articulated somewhere along the line, or they don't know why they're doing what they're doing. This is kind of like a Simon Sinek thing of like, start with why, of like, why, what is this all about? What is this for? What are we doing this for? Who are we doing this for? And if you don't have that, I think you end up spinning people off in sort of chaotic directions that either they sabotage each other or they sabotage the project, not necessarily intentionally, but just because it's clear that they don't see the thing the same way. So, you know, what did you do, or how does one help a team see that vision as a collective?
Everyone comes at it based on their own background. So I think the way a senior manager will see the work that needs to be done will be very different from the way a developer is going to see it. So I mm-hmm. think part of that is about kind of smashing their worlds together.
Yeah.
And as quickly and efficiently as possible. And I mean, to be honest, yes, there can easily be some resistance, especially from the more senior people, that they don't want to get down into the detail. But I think with something like software development, that's quite complex. I mean, you can have one little technical detail over in some remote code base that actually means that you need to completely change the project plan, if not what you're building. And it's like, I think with work that's complex, which is much more based on experimentation and exploring and all that, the reason it's complex is because of those potential dependencies, and you can't manage it like a factory, right, where you just kind of go and you have someone senior saying that, you know, you need to come up with, you know, 20 screens and 30 tables and 40 forms and then we're done. Like
it gets back to defining it. It's defining the results of the work in a way that's actually aligned with the goal of the work. Right. I mean, it sounds like when, you know, the example you just gave, it's like, well, 20 tables that don't work is irrelevant. It's not going to help anything. So the question is it better to come up with 3 tables that actually do the thing we're trying to do and help our customer or whatever our target goal is? This is back to this quantifying thing of like, you can't quantify creative work in the same way. You have to evaluate it on the basis of whether it works in the end, right? Mm-hmm. Like whether it does what it's supposed to do. Otherwise, exactly, you end up with, you know, a paperweight. It's not helpful. So really the job of the manager, it sounds like, is actually being kind of a liaison between the team and the people who are the stakeholders, who are, you know, who have a particular need that needs to get defined. And sometimes their need is, we need to, you know, increase our revenue by X dollars. Well, that's something to know. You know, you might not be able to do it per se, but knowing that it's part of the goal,
context,
you know, yeah, helps, I think, for the team to understand that, helps them go, okay, well, so this thing has to get done by, you know, January, because we have to achieve this goal or the company's going to go out of business, you know, so we're going to have to put something out there. And that balances out trying to go for perfection. But anyway, that it's that bridge that really defines the role of the manager, I think, or at least in part.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think to your question, I mean, I think the key thing with the manager, certainly speaking for myself when I was in that situation, kind of being in the middle, I mean, a lot of this was about, on one hand, opening up everyone's perspective, on the other hand, making sure everything that I hear and see is internally consistent. And especially initially, there wasn't a lot of internal consistency. So I think a lot of it is about having the people on various sides hear about data points from the other side that are relevant or important that impact the overall goal. And I think just aiming for that increasing internal consistency is how that alignment is achieved. And I think initially a large part of the challenge is just that everyone's used to where they were or the way things are, or, you know, how things have always been done, that you, you know, often do need to be able to shake things up a little bit in order to loosen things up if necessary, to then actually go and figure out a better way to align it later. And by internally consistent, I mean, apologies for the for the technical metaphors, which for some reason I've really gone in that direction today.
Yeah, it's okay.
I mean, it's the way I always thought about it was like, you know, it's almost like an internally consistent database, right? Like if you've got this data point showing this value, it's got to coincide with a different value that I'm seeing somewhere on some other web page or that kind of thing. So if I hear a senior executive say that we need things done by this and this date, and then on the other hand, I've got developers saying, well, it's going to take 2.5 years to do it. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, that clearly is not internally consistent. Therefore, there's a need to go and dig into that and figure out how to align the expectations on both sides, basically.
Exactly. Makes complete sense. All right. I want to be respectful of your time. So I want to begin to wrap this up. And one of the things I want to do is make sure you have a chance to talk about your book for a second, the actual book. Sure. The book is published on this Lean Pub publishing model, which I found really interesting. And while you're telling us what the heck that means, you can tell people how to find it.
Yeah, sure. So initially I started with Lean Pub. In fact, it's the second book that I've published on there. I write on Lean Pub. I then also cross post to Amazon. So there's also Kindle versions. Mm-hmm. So essentially the Lean Pub approach is that you write books or written content similar to the way software is developed. So it's kind of like continuous delivery for books, like a chapter at a time, for example. Uh-huh. At a high level, that's the idea. And then it's using things like source control, like Git, which allows you to be very precise when you are versioning and changing things of exactly what's changed in between each particular tweak. Uh-huh.
Do you need to be conversant with Git to use it? Is that part of the deal?
You don't need to. They do have different modes of writing, but I think they do presume a certain level of comfort with techie stuff, mm-hmm. which just from what I've seen, I mean, they definitely do support you if you do have questions, but they also do expect you to try to figure stuff out a little bit. Yeah, that's kind of been my experience. I mean, the nice thing about Lean Pub is that it does already have a built-in, let's say, technical audience of early adopters. So if you're writing that type of book, I think it's very good. Mm-hmm. And also you can kind of build the audience as you're writing it. So you can already be growing a community around a book as it's being written, mm-hmm. and, or, you know, let's say offering parts of it for less, if you want earlier. So starting to sell it even before it's completed, if it, you know, if it's at a point where you think people will be able to get value from it before it's done, then you have the option of doing that. And I think this community is okay with that. Whereas I don't think that would be true of Amazon, where,
right. you know,
I think if someone buys a book on Amazon, they expect it to be done.
Right. Sure. Sure. But it's an interesting idea to be able to sort of participate in the process of an author's development and sort of learn gradually. I mean, usually most people don't read a book in one sitting. Right. And so, you know, if you read a chapter and then the guy comes up with another chapter in a week or two, that's kind of a cool way of experiencing an author's
thought process.
And then I assume that also kind of means the book is never done, right? That you could continue to edit it as long as you want to, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the basic idea is that if someone buys the book, then they get all future revisions of it too, which I think is also a departure from reading a traditional paper book.
Yeah.
So anything from, you know, fixing typos, which do occasionally show up in printed books, to, mm-hmm. you know, rewrites, changes in thought process, future editions, that kind of thing. So it's up to the author and, you know, or the authoring team, mm-hmm. when they believe it's done and when they want to stop. And if they want, they can keep refining and adding as their thinking evolves, so to speak. Mm-hmm. How that changes the reader experience. At this point, I guess I'm too close to it to be able to judge, yeah. to be honest.
Well, we'll see. But it's fascinating to see where publishing is going. It's definitely changing so quickly. And the book, by the way, is available in paperback as well, right? You can order an actual copy on Amazon?
It isn't yet. It was briefly. I've pulled it back. I think there's a few changes I still want to make. But yeah, it's coming.
So, fine. Great. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, people are anxious to read it. They can go get the electronic version, the digital version. It's good. Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right. Well, there's many more questions I could continue on with, but I think we should have people investigate you on their own. So, tell everybody where they can find you online.
Yeah, absolutely. So the website for the podcast is managingremoteteams.co, and the book website is alignremotely.com. And I'm also on the various socials. I think there's 6 different sites where everywhere is managing remote teams, except Twitter, where it's managing_remote. And I think Twitter and LinkedIn are probably the main ones in terms of where I actually spend time. So
great. That's great. Well, I hope people listen to the podcast, read the book, and it's been a pleasure, Luke. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, that's it for now. If you're new to working from home, you might want to check out worklifeathome.com, where you'll find articles, show notes, and best of all, a community where you can ask questions and get some answers from people who've been doing this a while. We'd love to see you there. And I would be thrilled to hear what you think and find out who else you'd like to hear from on the show. You can email me at josh@worklifeathome.com. If you're enjoying Work Life at Home, please do let your friends and coworkers know so they can subscribe. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon.